Major Cochrane, Reel 7. You were explaining the sort of organisation of the Cameron Highlanders, you know, generally, the, where the battalions were and what happened to them. And you said before that you'd had a bit of luck with...
Well, yes. Either it was luck, either I was a bloody nuisance, or I'd done all right, sort of, whatever jobs I had to do at the depot, because I was sent for and told I was going to be sent to join the 2nd Battalion in Egypt. On my way, I was not taking any soldiers with me, but I had to go to a camp in Ayrshire and collect a draft of 40 HLI, Highland Infantry Reservists, who'd been called back to the colours. So I duly did this.
Now, when was this? When did you... So it didn't sound like you were at the Cameron Barracks for long.
No, no. A month... Month or 5 weeks, I should think.
So if we around about to April.
Yeah, end of April almost. Well, middle of April, because I think I had 4 or 5 days embarkation leave, and this is when I got my valise and sleeping bag and you know, that ridiculous kind of folding bath wash basin thing that I don't think I ever used. Field kit. Plus, I was told that I had to carry, get a topi, sun helmet. And I arrived at this camp at a place called Barassi.
Now, hang on. What about your embarkation leave? What do you remember of that? How did you? Where did you spend it? And how did your family?
I spent that in London because my father and mother. Were living in London at that time. My sister had was just starting at Bedford College in London. This was before the bombing, because before they were all bombed out. So I had, I think, 5 days with them in London.
And how did your parents react to the fact you were going off?
Well, I think they could see I was pleased. And it sounded more interesting, really, than going to the 1st Battalion in France. I know I had reason for thinking this. And on visits to the Far East, when I still remembered steaming down the Suez Canal, so I thought, you know, Egypt, good, this would be a good thing to do. And they accepted it. And they knew I wouldn't be. I'd be posted abroad somewhere, probably. So it wasn't a great surprise to them that I was. This was au revoir for some time. Then, of course, it was really rather a fiasco, because I'd only picked up my 40 HLI people, who were to join their 2nd Battalion, also in Egypt, all wearing sun helmets, you know, pith helmets. So we set off looking like a sort of bad, I don't know, some Burgess or something, you know, ludicrously tropical-looking lot, marching through the Ayrshire fields to get in a train. Anyhow, we then joined up with more drafts for various regiments, all going to the Middle East. Some officers attached, some not attached. There were more HLI, two HLI subalterns, who with whom I'd been at Sandhurst, so I knew them. Down to the channel, across the channel, to, I think it was to Calais, on our way out, a long, long train journey to Marseille, and we got to Marseille when the troop ship, you could see it in the harbour, but by this time, of course, the invasion had started. And
the German Blitzkrieg.
Yes. We had spent some time in a terribly decrepit French barracks in Le Mans. And it was difficult because it wasn't a formed unit, it was a gaggle of bits of units. We couldn't even sort of march together because we had some light infantry with us, you know, marching at twice the step of some guardsmen. There was an officer in charge of the whole thing, but he had no, there was no proper command structure. Despite that, I suppose the thing did hang together a bit. But it was rather absurd to be at Marseille, see the troop ship in the harbour, and then to be told that the Navy decided Italy had come into the war by this time, and they couldn't spare destroyers to protect the troop ship. So we had to go all the way back again across France, very slowly, and with some prodding from us to get the engine drivers to carry on. They wanted to stop. We got as far as Cherbourg, which was in a state of chaos, trucks being burnt or pitched over the edge of the dock and so on. However, we got onto a steamer, and we were landed back, I think, Southampton or Portsmouth from Cherbourg. To be great embarrassment, met at every station, railway station, by kind ladies with cups of tea and sandwiches, as though we had been heroes of Dunkirk, instead of merely being sort of military commuters, more or less. That was very embarrassing. Then we were sent to Aintree, to the race course, by Doss Dye with two or three others in the Earl of Sefton's box. The troops were dotted all over the place. And eventually we embarked in Liverpool on the Aquitania. And that was still really almost in peacetime rig. I mean, so much so that in the lounges there were still discreet notices up saying that passengers were advised not to play games of cards with high stakes for strangers in the smoking room. Apparently the Atlantic ships were notorious for the card shops that used to travel on.
So would this be in late May or early June?
This would be June by now. I suppose they took some time deciding what to do, what to do with these drafts. Were they still going to send them to the Middle East or not? So we eventually set off. There was the Aquitania, the Mauritania, and I think it was a newish Mauritania, not the old original Mauritania, another big liner. It was the third ship. There was no escort because they were able to go at high speed. There were no cargo ships or anything. So off we went. Now it was perfectly comfortable for the officers, and unlike all later troop ships I was on, it wasn't too bad for the men, because there was enough space down below. There was deck space, so they could, you know, people weren't all cooped up. And the food was quite good. In addition, which was a great blessing, there was a full general hospital on board, which meant lots of pretty nurses, which alleviated the voyage considerably. And this was before the US came into the war and insisted that all troop ships must be dry. So you could get beer or a drink, a dram or a gin. This again helped a lot. So it wasn't at all a bad voyage from that point of view. We paused at Freetown, but then at Cape Town, it was then thought that we'd been several weeks without stretching our legs, and this was bad. So we disembarked at Cape Town, or rather in Freetown, to be round the corner, the naval base off Cape Town. And we were landed, and we route marched briskly here and there, but we also had time to go sightseeing. People were, you know, came down in hordes with cars, pick us up, take us away for lunch, or a tour around Cape Province. Very kind and very generous. And then from Cape Town across the Indian Ocean to Colombo, well, we didn't get ashore, but I had landed at Colombo a number of times as a boy. Interesting to see it again. Then up to Bombay, where again I'd once landed before. And at Bombay, the big ships, we disembarked and re-embarked on little, if you like, local steamers. The ones which used to go to and from India and the African ports and the Gulf port. And the big ships, I think, I'm not quite sure about this, I think they went on to Australia and New Zealand and picked up troops there and brought them back to either the Middle East or to or back to the UK. Probably the Middle East. Anyhow, as far as we were concerned, we got on these little ships and had a terrible voyage.
Do you know the name, or was it just too small to know?
No, I've forgotten the names of these.
And what month would this be you're on the steamer?
Well, it was, of course, very hot, wet, sticky. It was fairly rough in the monsoon. Everybody was seasick. The food was unbelievably bad, especially for the men. The conditions were appalling because their hammocks were absolutely jammed, you know, like sardines. People were sleeping on the mess tables. I don't think anybody could sleep on the floor because of cockroaches. But it really was horrible. And it did.
What was it like for you officers?
It was very disagreeable, but nothing like the conditions that the soldiers were in. And this was a thing that worried me a lot later on, because, in fact, I spent 9 months of the war at sea, which is more actually than some of my naval friends spent on troop ships going around the place. And I think the disparity between the men's accommodation and the officers' accommodation got worse as the war went on. Not that the officers' accommodation improved, but the men's got even worse than it was at this stage. Not only the accommodation, people would have forgiven quite a lot if at least they'd had something decent to eat. But the food really was filth. On one occasion what made it worse, as I say, we were there as a disorganized series of disparate groups, not a formed unit. But one's obviously one was responsible for my 40 HRI people had diminished a bit because they did tend to get terribly drunk at various places. So I left a few of them in police stations.
What sort of you mentioned that in your book, the disciplinary problems. What was the what sort of things would they get up to?
Well, it was mostly one or two of them were sort of really hard cases as far as drink was concerned. If there was no booze, was there any methylated spirit? Or if there wasn't any methylated spirit, was there any brass herb? Because there is a powerful spirit in the stuff you clean your brass with. Of course, it's poisonous. It really is locked up. That was one problem. The other was that they were perfectly well behaved until, if you like, we had a run ashore, and then everybody felt the need to blow off steam. And they would blow off steam in rather too exuberant a way. And
what sort of thing?
Well, you know, crown a policeman just because he was a policeman, as though he were a bobby in a Glasgow street. There was no insubordination or mutinying or anything like this, but it was the sort of stuff that if we hadn't been on a troop ship and been an ordinary unit, a man would have had probably a fortnight's detention in the battalion guardroom, and so many hours of drill, packed drill, on the square, and an entry made in his conduct sheet, and if he was a NCO, probably demoted. This kind of thing. But I know one occasion on this infernal steamer, I was. You always, an officer attended, the orderly officer attended all meals, and any complaints were directed to him. And he had not, you weren't allowed to wait for complaints, you had to ask in ringing tones any complaints. And on this one occasion, I was orderly officer, went down to this really stinking, heaving mess of humanity cooped up in this sweltering wet heat. And I didn't need even to have a complaint. I said to the nearest soldier, you know, what the hell is this? And he said, well, you say you can look at it and see or smell it. And I took his, I said, I'll let you have your mess tin later. I took his mess tin and went up to the dining saloon where the officers were all having their lunch, and the ship's colonel, who was commanding the whole thing, sitting with the ship's captain. And I said, excuse me, sir, I'm the orderly officer on duty today, and would you just mind looking and smelling this? And I shoved this mess tin full of filth right under his nose, and he you know, what the hell do you think you're doing? He got very angry, and I said, well, he wasn't my colonel or anything to do with me. I knew I'd never see him once we'd got ashore, so I didn't mind much what I said. But I said that, you know, the soldiers down there are having an intolerable time, and they're fed with filth like this. Well, what do you expect me to do about it? And I said, well, you can tell the captain for one thing, who's sitting at his elbow, and I suggest you put a report to the authorities when we arrive, that the army can speak to the shipping company about these conditions. I can see him. I mean, if I had been in his squad, I'd have had very short shifts, but as I say, it made no difference, but it got some spleen out of me.
Now, how long were you on these various boats? The first boat, the Aquitania, you left in June 40.
I got off the second boat at Port Said, where I have joined the battalion, or rather I was on my way on dry land to join the battalion in the end of July, beginning of August. That was nearly 8 weeks, I think.
Now, what about your first impressions when you got off at Port Said?
Well, the first thing was to find, you know, by this time, of course, we've been wandering around like lost sheep for so many weeks that the units we were supposed to join, I imagine, had even forgotten our existence. So the first thing was to get some message to the 2nd HLI, by this time about only 30 of their reservists were waiting to be handed over. So I got them handed over to the HLI. I was told where I could find the 2nd Battalion of the Cameron Highlanders, which was up in the desert. This time they moved from Egypt and were up the line in the desert.
Whereabouts?
It was called the position was called the Bagouche Box. It was supposed to be a sort of box-like fortified area, if you like. And I think, if I'm right, the railway station was in fact called Bagouche. The railway station was a very small hut and a signal
What about the journey there then?
Well,
were you on your own or?
Yeah, on my own. And I really got more and more nervous the nearer I got, because such a long time had elapsed since I'd left the depot. And then I began getting cold feet by joining a regular battalion. And as I said, nobody else going up the line to join any other regiment. There wasn't a sapper or a gunner, a junior officer, anybody else. So I really felt rather blue, and then didn't arrive until
What do you remember of the train journey? Was it anything of note? Or
no, I mean, it just, once you were out of the actual delta, because there are various towns in once you left Cairo, you of course branched off just short of Alexandria, and you passed through various busy active small towns, and then once you were a few miles beyond Alex, it was just desert the whole way.
So what happened when you got there? The station, I think, was in your book, it's Gawala.
Gawala,
yeah. Right.
Yes. Well, I was in the dark. There was a signaller there, a British Army signaller. Of course, the railways were still run by the Egyptian state railways. They weren't militarized. And there was a Egyptian, well, station manager, you'd like to call it that, one chap in charge. But the army signaler sent a signal through, which got eventually to the Camerons that I was there. And eventually a truck arrived, picked me up. And I'd driven in the dark, bumping along, cross country. To eventually a fairly large marquee, which turned out to be the headquarters, mess, everything else, of the battalion, and in the dark was introduced to the colonel and the adjutant, and I was given a whiskey and some biscuits to eat, and told I better go and get some sleep. And of course that was it. Now this was good in a way, good luck. The battalion was spread over a big patch of desert, sort of three rifle cutters. Of the four rifle companies, three I think were forward, one was in reserve. The battalion headquarters with the administrative staff were behind all this. So there was no officer's mess, if you like. There was no sergeant's mess. You lived with your company. And the result was that I saw very little of officers in other companies or officers at HQ. But of course, got to know my company, officers and NCOs and men, very much better and very much sooner than if, for example, we'd been in barracks and not, in fact, living.
Now, you were in C Company.
Then I was sent, in the morning after my arrival, I was told I was going to C Company, and the intelligence officer, I was pleased to find out, was also another temporary wartime officer. I wasn't the only one. He drove me up a truck, as I got, and I introduced to the company commander, and there's one other officer, so I made the third number three, and that was it. And the company commander, Donald Bannerman, who was a very senior officer indeed. He must have been 40, I suppose, which to me was a vast age. He'd been in the regiment just at the end of World War I.
Now, what was he like?
Well, he was. He certainly was a good officer. He was. He had a lot of experience. He had been a subaltern in the regiment, in that white Russian business in the Caucasus at the end of World War One, when the white Russians were fighting the new Red Army, and Britain sent some various military expeditions both to the Archangel area in the north and to the Caucasus in the south. He had served with the battalion in India. He was in fact a good linguist, good enough. I mean, he'd learnt, he was a Russian speaker, good enough to have the full army qualification of interpreter. But he was a bit aloof, and I don't think it was at all that he couldn't be bothered, Miss Beaver. I think it was just an age gap, really. I mean, he could have been my father or my uncle, and I was obviously just a sort of pup to him. He never behaved in that way to me, but I respected him, and he was always very good to me, but I felt much closer to the other officer in the company, who became a very good, a very close friend. In fact, years later, he was best man at our wedding.
Now that would be Lieutenant David Douglas.
That's right.
Now what was he like?
Well, he was, I suppose, not even, he was older than I was, but younger than Donald Bannerman. And I only learned long afterwards, not long, but sometime afterwards. And he told me that he had been, his father had been in the regiment, he'd enlisted in the early 30s, I think, yes. He'd become a company sergeant major by the time the war started, and he was commissioned. If you were commissioned, you became a lieutenant straight away. You didn't go through the indignity of becoming a second lieutenant. And in fact, he was promoted captain and then major shortly afterwards. But I thought it was good marks. Donald Bannerman never said to me that David Douglas, of course, he was a CSM 12 months ago, or 6 months ago. Nor did anybody in the company, either the private soldiers or the NCOs. The person who told me was David himself.
So there was no prejudice in the unit or your company anyway against ranker officers?
Absolutely not. And not only no prejudice against it, but it wasn't even thought worthy of mention, you know, as an interesting fact. Partly this could have been due to the fact that the then second in command, who by the time we began serious fighting, was the colonel. Colonel Anderson, Andy Anderson. He, in World War One, had enlisted as a private soldier. He was a sergeant, I think, in 1914. He too had been commissioned in the field in about 1915. But in those days, it was thought impolitic or wrong, or wasn't done anyhow, for a commissioned ranker to serve in the same unit in which he'd been a sergeant or a company sergeant major. So Andy Anderson had gone off in 1960, I think, to what was then a completely new machine gun corps. And he'd rejoined